Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We have long learned that policing is tough and a very consequential job. Little decisions and large ones put life and death quickly on the line. If there's bias, justice is quickly on the line, too. If there's video, that has its own effect. NPR's Kelly McEvers has gone deep on the intersection of policing and video for her podcast Embedded. She's got striking stories. This hour on Point, police, video, life, death, and justice. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do we learn when we watch American policing? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Kelly McEvers, host of the NPR podcast Embedded, joins us in just a moment. But first, I want to get the latest on body cams and American police. Jamiles Larte joins me from New York, reporter for The Guardian. Jamiles, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Tom. Great to be with you.
After Ferguson and all the rest, Black Lives Matter and all the rest, there was a lot of talk about more body cameras and their adoption by American police departments. How's that push going, Jamiles?
Well, that's right. So, you know, in 2015, we saw body cameras become sort of an integral part of this conversation about holding police accountable, about, you know, having evidence during law enforcement situations, investigations, where there were conflicting reports, conflicting stories. And to date, what I can tell you is that a study done by the Major Cities Chiefs Association, which basically has police chiefs from all the large departments in the country, says that about half of departments nationwide right now are either fully rolled out or are at least trialing programs to have their officers wearing body cameras.
And when you say fully rolled out, does that mean every officer with a body camera at all times when he's on or she's on the job or not?
Well, right. And so that's, you know, that's where this conversation tends to get interesting. And, you know, we have to recognize that there are about 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. And each one of those agencies at the current moment, you know, at most, they have state law telling them how and when to use body cameras. But for the most part, it's really decided on an agency by agency basis. So for some, that means that all interactions, you know, must be recorded. For others, officers have quite a bit of discretion in terms of when they turn on their body cameras. And then, you know, other departments, they're not mandatory and they're optional, and officers can choose whether or not they want to participate in that program. Many choose to because in their eyes, a body camera is the best way to protect themselves from claims of, you know, misconduct or police brutality or, you know, different incidents with the public.
Well, what about that, Jamiles? Rank and file police reception. Have you seen large surveys on that, whether most police are ready, willing, and as you describe it right there, maybe even eager to have the camera on? Or does the preponderance go the other way? Don't want that kind of record of every interaction.
Right. I haven't seen a study. What I have seen is quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that it kind of goes both ways. But for the most part, I think officers at least want to appear open and receptive to wearing these cameras and sort of operate from the point of view that they have nothing to hide. So I haven't seen a lot of resistance. The resistance tends to come in the situations where it becomes more prescriptive about when and where those cameras have to be operating. And, you know, privacy concerns about being allowed to turn the cameras off when they're, you know, talking with their partners.
Yep.
Or in the station or not in a direct interaction with a citizen.
Of course, it's not only police body cams that put video out there of these interactions. I mean, just on Friday, and these videos, almost every time hot ones come out, they become part of the national conversation. Just last Friday, there was this video, police responding to a 911 call in Vallejo, California, that said a man was acting crazy at a gas station there, and that takedown of that man by police caught on camera. Witnesses say the officer went too far. Crowd gathered there. People saying brutality, brutality. The officer ultimately drew his gun, waved at the crowd, you know, wailing on the guy on the ground. Here's the report from CBS News.
A violent police encounter caught on tape. An officer hitting a suspect with his fist and flashlight.
Police brutality! I am God!
Why are you still hitting me, huh? Police all over this guy. The guy on the ground saying, I am God, I am God. It is always volatile stuff, Jamiles, when these videos come out. I mean, it's hard to watch, and then there's always the interpretation. Was that appropriate force? Was it too much? Was the police officer laying it on all the way to brutality, or just trying to subdue a guy who wasn't easily subdued?
Right. So I won't chime in and give you, you know, sort of a decision on whether it was excessive force or not as a reporter. But what I will tell you is that, you know, from having spoken with law enforcement officials and people who look at these types of use of force situations, there's going to be sort of three points that are going to be looked at in this investigation. The first is the officer's decision to actually run after the man and initiate physical contact with a suspect who was, you know, already on the ground and giving himself up, or so it appeared.
He sat down in the median after a chase around, but he finally just sat down, and then the cop got on him.
Right, exactly. So there's that point. The second point will be the actual, you know, the physical attack, if you want to call it that, and the use of hands,
subduing,
and,
yep.
And arms,
yep,
to subdue him. The third point, and probably the one where the officer faces the most possibility of being reprimanded, would be pulling his gun out at the crowd that had gathered, because very few, and I haven't reviewed the Vallejo use of force policy,
yeah.
But I've looked at hundreds of use of force policies over the last 2 years, and very few would make you know, pulling a weapon out at a crowd,
waving it at citizen bystanders, even if they are upset.
Right. There's very few things that would sort of allow that. Now, the sort of caveat here is that, for the most part, people who defend law enforcement will jump to, you know, if an officer feels that their life is in danger, they have a right to pull their weapon. But this seems like where he's going to face the most jeopardy. Interestingly, you know, the second part of the video, the part that's the hardest to watch,
yep,
is probably the one that's least in question. Generally speaking, you know, whether people in the public agree with it or not, once an officer and a suspect are engaged in physical hand-to-hand combat, mm-hmm, of any kind,
mm-hmm,
generally the way that goes is that the officer has to do what the officer is given a lot of leeway to do what they need to do to bring that person under control, because there's now a situation where, if that suspect who's in close proximity to the officer's gun,
mm-hmm,
were able to get a hold of it, that can be a threat to the officer's life or to the life of the general public.
And so there's a lot of punching to watch there, a lot of that big, heavy flashlight coming down, but that's part of the rough and tumble very, very, very often, you say, Jamiles.
Absolutely. And you know, and something that makes it even more interesting is that brings us back to the officer's initial decision to engage with the suspect
in that, you know, way,
and to get so close, because a term that we started hearing after the Tamir Rice case a lot was officer created jeopardy, right? The idea that a situation becomes more dangerous because, mm-hmm, of an officer's decision, which then leads to a situation where the officer can use deadly force because it has become dangerous, But it wouldn't have been dangerous if they hadn't made that initial decision, right? So every time an officer goes to get on the ground and grapple with a suspect,
yep.
Especially someone who hasn't been accused of doing anything particularly violent, you're now putting yourself in a situation where that person is within a few feet of your gun, and now it's more dangerous. So the people reviewing that will have to contend with that question of whether there's sort of a degree of officer-created danger there.
And, of course, when it's on video, very often we all become witnesses and, in a sense, kind of informal judges. Jamal Larte with The Guardian in New York. Thank you very much for kicking us off today, Jamal. Thanks very much for being with us.
Truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Kelly McEvers is with us right now from Culver City, California, co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, host of the NPR podcast, embedded in the midst of its second season right now. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That Vallejo encounter is exactly the kind of thing that keeps people interested in these videos and what they mean. How did you decide to dive in on police and the video record of their interactions?
You know, just like you were talking about with Jamiles, we are seeing just so many more of these videos as more and more of these 18,000 police departments across the country adopt a policy of using body cams. Again, there's still a question of whether or not they're going to release those videos, but a lot of them do after an incident like this. Or they're, you know, we're also seeing civilian videos of incidents like this that end up in the news. We thought it would make a lot of sense to slow down and take a few of these videos and really just like dig in with the idea of kind of learning how to watch these videos. I don't know about you, but I think there was a time last summer when it seemed like there were just so many and they were happening in rapid succession.
Yes.
Philando Castile, cases in Louisiana. And then, of course, we also were seeing incidents where police were being shot. And so we said, we need to slow down. We need to take a look at these. We need to understand them and what they mean.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with NPR's Kelly McEvers about police and video in this country now. What we see, what we don't, what to make of the encounters. She's been digging in for the NPR podcast Embedded and joins us today from Culver City, California. You may have been thinking about this as well, as police and video have become so central very often to our culture in recent years. Are you seeing more body cams out there on police? Police officers, what do you think of having your work on video? Does it change the way you do your job? Why do so many police resist wearing a body cam? And can video, police video, tell us the story, the whole story? Kelly, I think the last time I saw you, we were in Phoenix, Arizona. You were headed to Flagstaff. You have quite a story out of there. We'll hear that. Your first episode in this round of embedded episodes was set in Charlotte, North Carolina. I want to go to the tape quickly, but just set it up for us. What were you looking at there?
It was a case in, it was a shooting in 2013. Mm-hmm. This was early on in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's about a year after Trayvon Martin was shot, about a year before Ferguson and Michael Brown was shot. So, I mean, we've had videos of shootings for a long time, but this is in the Black Lives Matter era. There was a video, a partial video of a shooting of a man named Jonathan Farrell. He was an unarmed black man. He was shot by a white police officer. Just a tiny bit of the incident was captured on video. He shows up in the headlights of a police car. It's actually a dash cam video. It's not a body cam. And you see the red beams of a taser hit his chest. Mm-hmm. It turns out that taser didn't work. That was one officer. Another officer saying, get on the ground, get on the ground.
Kelly, hold the thought right there. Let's go to the embedded tape because it's so good. Here from NPR's Embedded, Kelly McEvers, Charlotte, North Carolina.
A woman has called 911 and said a black man is trying to break into her house. In the car, the dispatcher says on the radio, the suspect has tried to kick in the woman's door. And you can see what happens next. The officer pulls up to the scene. His headlights shine on a black man in a green T-shirt and light-colored pants on the side of the road near the woman's house. He matches the description of the suspect. His name is Jonathan Farrell. At first, you see Jonathan Farrell walking toward the cops. Then you see both his hands go to his waist, like he might be pulling up his pants. And then you see a red dot on his chest. We later learn it's from another officer's taser. And then Jonathan Farrell starts to run. And he runs right off camera. So now we don't see anyone in the video. All that's left is audio. You hear a third officer, Randall Wes Carrick, tell Jonathan Farrell to stop. And then you hear this. 12 gunshots. 4, then 6, then 1, then 1.
Shots fired.
Officers handcuff Jonathan Farrell, tell him not to move.
Don't move!
And then he dies.
Kelly McEvers from the podcast Embedded in Charlotte, North Carolina. Well told, terrible story. He dies. There's a trial. Who's on trial for what? And let's cut to the chase. What's the outcome?
Right. The officer, Wes Carrick, is on trial for voluntary manslaughter. I mean, this video, though inconclusive, you don't see the actual thing happening on video. Investigators, including the chief of police at the time, who was the first black police chief in Charlotte, North Carolina, watched that video, said this man was unarmed and there was more force that was used than was necessary. It goes to trial. The defense and the prosecution both show the video. Each of them used the video to tell their own narrative, and the jury sides with the defense. It's actually 8-4 in favor of acquitting Officer Carrick. They can't resolve it. They deadlock. The judge declares a mistrial, and the prosecution does not retry the case. So Wes Carrick, the officer, goes free, but in the end settles with the city, and part of that settlement, he resigns from the police force. So he is no longer a police officer.
What's the racial makeup of the jury that did that?
So, right. So it's an 8-4 split on the jury. Most of the 8 are white. Most of the 4 are people of color. It's not a perfect split on racial lines, but the majority of the 8 who voted to side with the white officer were white.
And at the heart of it was how people interpreted that video. And this is here from the first episode. We've got some of your sound here from Embedded. This is Bruce, is it Rafe, foreman on the jury in this case. We should say he's white. And he's describing, Kelly McEvers goes down and digs this out for us, what he saw in the video.
A young man, distraught, disheveled, confused, angry, if you will, making a very aggressive move towards these police officers after disobeying commands. He had many choices in this video, and it was clear from the very first time I viewed it. Stop, sit down, put your hands up, do any of those things other than what you chose to do, which was to charge Officer Carrick. And so there's no other way around what I saw, and I kept coming back to that.
No other way around it from the jury foreman. But you've also got Moses Wilson, who you tracked down for Embedded, another juror who's black, thought the officer should have been convicted of manslaughter. He says the defense tried to put Jonathan Farrell, the man who died, on trial.
This is an old trick from defense attorneys. He wasn't supposed to be here. He might have had a few drinks where he was. The police responded to what he caused. This was early in the morning. This was far from where he lived. This was that, which caused me at the end to write on the board, just what did he do to deserve to be shot so many times? In the jury room. I wrote this on the board. I heard all these things, but what did he do? And the defense for Carrick could not come up with anything that he had done.
Moses Wilson says he thinks some people voted to acquit because of race.
That is the most, that is the deepest and the darkest of reasons, and it will haunt whoever did it for the rest of their lives. That's the truth.
Kelly McEvers on the ground for the NPR podcast Embedded. What's the insight about policing and video that comes out of this sad case, Kelly?
when not everything happens on camera, and even when everything does happen on camera, different people can see the exact same thing in very different ways. Lawyers, investigators, you know, journalists, mm-hmm. you know, once they tell a story, you can latch on to that story, but it might be the exact opposite story that somebody else has. I mean, we've heard about confirmation bias for a long time in mm-hmm. courtrooms. This is not new. But now that we have these pieces of evidence, right, we think that these videos are giving us more information than we ever had before. You know, back in the day, if there was an officer-involved shooting, they would just fill out a report, and that report might go into a basement, and we wouldn't really ever hear anything else about it. He would say, well, the guy was going for my gun, and that was it. Yep. Now we do have more evidence, and we mm-hmm. think that that's getting us really far, and I think the conclusion we drew was, well, it's moving the needle a bit, but it's not getting us everything we need.
It's great to have you go in and dig in on it. Here you're talking again with that jury foreman, Bruce Raffi, about how he thinks people can watch the same video and come to different conclusions. Kelly McKevers from Embedded.
It's almost disheartening because you can't.
You feel so strongly, like you feel very confident, you're 100% confident in your decision, but then to be sitting right next to somebody else who's that confident in the opposite thing based on the same set of facts.
I'm wondering what they're not seeing, what they didn't hear, why aren't they, you know, siding with me on this decision. I felt very confident that the decision that I was making and the decisions that I was formulating to know that Officer Kerrick was not guilty, I had a hard time understanding why others didn't.
But they certainly didn't. You get video and you get different views. Kelly McKevers bringing that to us from Embedded. Donnie in Pembroke Pines, Florida. Donnie, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Kelly.
Mr. Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
No. One common thing that you can see in these videos is that the suspect is resisting arrest. In one way, in any form that the suspect resists arrest, the minute that happens, I believe the police officer and the police department should be exonerated from any lawsuits or bad publicity. Because, you know, otherwise we won't have a society. All these individuals are resisting arrest in one form or another.
Kelly, respond to that. Donnie, I appreciate your call from Florida. Yeah. Kelly, what do you say?
Well, first of all, it's hard to say that the same thing is true for all of these videos. I mean, I think we can't say that. And I think professional investigators looked at this one and said, we see a man who's running away from police. I mean, that is what professional investigators in this case said. I don't get to make a judgment. That's what they said. But I mean, this is the thing, right? When you've got people who are on juries who, you know, by and large believe in police and trust in police and the job that they do, and when they're given the instruction that you're not here to decide whether this shooting was right or wrong. You're here to decide whether this shooting was reasonable, right? There's a Supreme Court case that dictates all of these cases. And the idea is that the juror has to put him or herself in the shoes of the police officer and ask, was this a reasonable use of force? And a lot of times still, even though we're seeing more police get charged in these cases, you still got jurors who are going to say, it was reasonable. Just like you heard Bruce Raffi say, I saw a man running at police. I saw a man who should have sat down, who was resisting arrest, as Donnie is saying. You know, and again, that might be true. It's just what we raised with this reporting was there's another perspective on this particular case that a lot of people held.
Let's complicate this picture, as you do in the second episode of this round of Embedded that airs tomorrow, March 16th, looks at video of a police shooting in Flagstaff, Arizona. This was a couple of years back. I'm going to play a chunk of tape here, Kelly McKevers, but you hear a lot from the video, the tape of that day. There's a police officer, Tyler Stewart, was following up on a domestic violence incident with a guy named Robert Smith, the boyfriend of a woman who called to report that he had trashed her place. And you may not expect exactly what happens here. This police officer certainly did not. And it is a, I'll say right up front, this is tough. It's a bloody ending. Here we go with the tape from Embedded.
Can you talk outside?
Smith says, yeah, they can talk outside, but turns back inside for a minute. Officer Stewart follows him all of the way. Smith goes back into his bedroom for a second, then comes out with a stocking hat on and one hand in his coat pocket. And then they go back outside.
All right. You don't have any weapons in your pockets or anything like that?
No, sir, I'm just cold.
Okay.
My tooth does not let me eat in days.
Okay.
And then they just talk, like for what seems like a pretty long time. Officer Stewart wants to know about the damage to the girlfriend's apartment, like some nail polish that got spilled on the floor.
The polish?
Some other stuff that got broken.
So the pumpkin got knocked over.
And you can see Officer Stewart look down at Smith's pocket. Smith still has his hand in there.
You don't have anything in here?
No, no.
And then he finally asks Smith if he can pat him down.
Okay. Nothing in here?
No, this is my smoke.
Okay.
And then, out of nowhere, Smith whips a gun out of his pocket. It happens so fast you can barely see it. And the video just stops. Here's what we know happens next. Robert Smith shoots Officer Tyler Stewart 5 times, then shoots himself.
Kelly McEvers from Embedded. And the death toll there, Kelly?
2. The officer was killed, and the shooter took his own life.
Okay.
And so this is a different kind of video, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a video where a police officer is the victim. And this is the kind of video that police officers watch and that police officers share. This thing has been viewed hundreds of thousands of times on YouTube. It's shared on blogs, on Facebook groups. It's used in training courses all around the country because police say this is the kind of danger they face every day. This is what they have to be prepared for. This is why they have to use force sometimes. Tyler Stewart, he was a young guy. He'd only been a cop for 7 months. His own father, you know, talks about how, you know, he possibly did make some mistakes that day. He's actually happy that the video of this incident is being shared because he, you know, he's comforted by the idea that, you know, other officers can watch it and maybe think about how to do their jobs better. But, you know, it's an interesting one because in this way, it's sort of a video that took on an afterlife. The facts of the video are not in dispute. We know mm-hmm. what happens. It's not like the one we talked about from Charlotte, North Carolina, where mm-hmm. a lot happens off camera and everybody sees a different thing. We know what happens here, but it takes on this other life and, you know, what it comes to mean to different people is very interesting because it's very different depending on who you talk to. I mean, it is weird to go to one of these police trainings, yeah. all-day police training. We went yeah. to one and just watch video after video after video after video like this and wonder, is that a good idea? I mean, police yeah. are getting killed. The numbers are still pretty low despite the couple of really big killings that we saw in the news in Louisiana and Dallas, of course, of police. It's not happening that often. And so the question is, like, to show it this much at training, does that psych police officers out too much? Is this propaganda? You know, are they using it in a bad way to say, like, see, this is why we have to use force?
Yeah.
There's just a lot of questions about how a video like this gets used. And then we actually talked to the relatives and the friends of Robert Smith, the guy who shot the officer and shot himself, and actually witnesses who were there that day, who were standing right there when that video was being shot.
I've got a little tape from his roommate, Joe Rivard. Yeah. You spoke with him about the afterlife of the video.
It feels invasive. It feels strange, very strange, very surreal. You know, if people can learn from it, then I understand. But people just watching something to kind of, like, for a spectacle, you know, for the same reason I would watch Cops. It feels a little sick.
Roommate of the man in Flagstaff who shot the police officer and himself. Do these videos just become part of the perpetual culture? Are they out there or are they in police vaults?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he talks about it, right? Like, it's like people watching Cops. I mean, there is, you know, this has been watched hundreds of thousands of times on YouTube. That isn't all just police watching it. I mean, that's just
why is it even there? Who put it up there?
Right. I mean, I think when a news organization has mm-hmm. it, they might put it up there. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I think mm-hmm. once it is made public, people will put it up there.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the people who were there that day, it's this loop of the worst day of their life
mm-hmm.
playing over and over and over again on the internet. And that's hard.
Yeah.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with NPR's Kelly McKevers about police and video in this country. Now, what we see, what we don't, what to make of the encounters trapped on video. She's been digging in for the NPR podcast Embedded and joins us today from Culver City, California. You can join us as well. What's your police video story? What do you think of how all this plays out? We heard that terrible story in Flagstaff where the officer goes in, pulls the guy out of the house. The guy's got his hands in his pockets. Anything in there? No, just smokes. But what comes out is a .22 caliber pistol, and the officer dies and the suspect dies. That Flagstaff video is being used in police training all over the country. Here's a little bit from Embedded. John Glennon, former police officer who trains police around the country. In this bit from Embedded, Jim Glennon has just finished playing that video at a training session.
He waits, lets it sink in. The people in the room just sit there for a minute. And then Jim makes his point.
People are programmed to believe violence is what they see on TV. The music starts to well up. You got a different camera angle. You know the guy's a bad guy. But in real life, it happens in the blink of an eye.
And in that case, two dead, including a police officer. Kelly McKevers, lots of response here online. Here one listener says, demilitarize the police. If you're killing people, you're not bringing them to justice. And you've failed at your job. You're not soldiers. You don't need to engage. Back off. Call for backup. De-escalate. Another listener says, as the police and the rest of the surveillance state constantly remind us, if you're doing nothing wrong, you have nothing to fear. Same rules for body cameras for police. Let them roll. Stephen in Delray Beach, Florida. Stephen, you're on with Kelly McKevers. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Okay.
Hey.
Good. So I was listening to you had a caller that had called in and mentioned that resisting arrest is a precedent that should exonerate the officers. There's a section of individuals that I've met and I've spoken with who think that this sort of behavior justifies a death sentence, because that's ultimately what it is. It's a death sentence.
Can be. Yep.
No long. I'm trying to understand the rationale behind that, of people saying that a death is acceptable for resisting arrest. I mean, if you look at situations like Eric Garner, I mean, this gentleman was obviously not a threat to the police officers, but yet some people say that his resisting justifies him being killed. So I think in that argument, it's frustrating for me to hear it. It's demoralizing to the people and to the families that have suffered, I think.
Kelly, you've been in the midst of this.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to that Supreme Court ruling, Graham v. Connor, and in this question of reasonableness. I mean, this is something that a lot of people are talking about, but it's a ruling that, again, dictates all of these cases. And when it's put to a jury, or when it's put to investigators, or when it's put to a prosecutor, whether or not to even charge the officer, the question is, was it reasonable for that officer to use force? And sometimes the answer is yes. When the person is resisting arrest, it is reasonable for that officer to use force. We may not think it's reasonable, but the people who are making the decision say it was reasonable, and they say, look, this Supreme Court case, this is the thing that dictates everything. And police, you know, are very aware of that case when they're out in the field.
Maybe too aware sometimes. And we've got to look through or around. I mean, look at the Eric Garner case. You know, he's selling cigarettes.
Was that reasonable?
Yeah.
Exactly. Was that reasonable? I mean, I think a lot of people would answer no. And here's the other thing that videos are doing for us, right? We have become, you know, the public now. We get to Monday Morning Quarterback, all of this stuff. Yeah. And police, honestly, they feel like they're under attack because of it. You know, they feel like they're being second-guessed. They feel they're like, hey, remember, we're the guys out here protecting you. We're the ones who, when you're running out of the Walmart when there's a shooter, we're the ones running in.
Yeah.
You know, we're the ones who are out here protecting you. Not all of us, you know, they like to use the sort of bad apples argument. Not all of us are going to be unreasonable. I mean, but
the details matter every single time. And I think your embedded reporting really bears that out. Hold that thought. Minnesota, Chatfield, Minnesota, Leslie is calling. Hi, Leslie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Boy, this is a heart-wrenching thing for me. I kind of get the attitude that you guys have the attitude that the cops are in the wrong.
No, we're watching the video. We're trying to figure it out. What do you think, Leslie?
Okay. Every single person that a police officer deals with, they have to be on guard. I wish every single person in this country could do a ride-along with an officer and put yourself in their shoes and see what the type of people they have to deal with. You don't know if they're whacked out on drugs. You don't know what you can't tell by looking if it's a good guy or a bad guy.
Yep.
But they have to trust their gut instincts at every single time they walk up to a car or open a door or approach anybody that is like, and then once everything escalates, they're trained to do certain things to avoid being in these situations. They have to make snap decisions, and everybody who sits back in their comfy chairs and watches it on TV and then says, oh, that's terrible, walk in their shoes for 1 second.
Leslie, we've got it. We've got it. We ask a lot of police officers, and there is no question about it. At the same time, we allow them in circumstances to use lethal force. And when anybody uses lethal force, it's worth really, we have to really pay attention to how that is used. But I take your point. I want to get one more and I'll bring it to you, Kelly. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, you're on the air. Thank you, Leslie. Elaine, you're on.
Thank you for your enlightening programs. I have 2 points. First of all, I'm a mental health therapist, and persons like the man that you mentioned in California who was saying, I am God, obviously displaying symptoms of mental illness. So what's needed in those situations is not shouting and beating, but a firm and soothing voice, a slow approach, the way you would approach a, you know, a scared animal or a scared child. So emotions run really high on both sides in these situations, and it's understandable that people just react from fear. And so what we need to do when we're training police is not only show them the possibility that they could get shot, but also show them the ways to handle situations, especially with mental ill persons, in a calm and effective way that are not going to just exacerbate things. So, you know, I think the training is critical because we do operate so often, especially in split-second situations, out of fear and not in a rational way. I've been in situations where I've met people with mental illness on the street, and you don't approach them in a hostile, aggressive, get down on the ground way. You approach them by saying, hello, how are you today? You know, I know it's...
Yeah, Elaine, we've got it. And I really appreciate your sort of mental health perspective on this and that kind of empathetic understanding of the fear police may feel. But hello, how are you may not always work depending on what kind of circumstance the police are coming into. Kelly, forgive me, I'm going to take one more, then I'll bring it all back to you. Kit in Savannah, Georgia. This is really interesting. Listeners paying close attention. Kit, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just calling to say that I think as a society, we kind of need to take a look at our justice system and decide if it's still the system that we want, where we have a jury of our peers for criminals before we make a decision on how we're going to, you know, handle the criminals. Because right now, we're letting the police act as judge, jury, executioner in one, you know, seconds. And I think we really need to ask ourselves, is that what we want? Because when you look at how often we hand out the death penalty when someone is on trial, even for sometimes really heinous crimes, it's not that often. And yet we're letting the police hand out the death penalty for really minor offenses because they think their life is in danger. And my grandfather is a policeman, and my perspective is you go into it knowing that it's a dangerous job.
Yeah.
But I don't think we should hand them over the right to then, you know, upend our justice system and become judge, jury, and executioner for us.
Kit, we've got it from Savannah. And, of course, the video is what lets these encounters linger so that mm-hmm. everybody becomes a kind of jury member here. You know, Kelly, I want to get you to respond to this, but it might be good to do it in the context of next week. You've got an embedded episode coming out, the podcast, from New Richmond, Ohio, and you go to a 2015 case there with Officer Jesse Kidder. Suspect is Michael Wilcox. And here's yet another stripe of encounter where I think you have to say the police officer shows an almost heroic restraint as, well, let's listen. This is Kelly McEvers from Embedded, the video.
Here's what the cop knows at this point. The man he's following is suspected of killing someone, and he has told the police he has a gun. The cop's been chasing him for a while, then the suspect drives onto a side street, gets out, and starts running at the cop. The cop gets out of his car with his gun drawn. This is where the video starts. The suspect says, "Shoot me." And the cop says he doesn't want to. The suspect starts running at the cop. Now he's got his hand in his pocket. And usually in videos like this, this is the moment when the officer shoots the suspect. And it's almost always ruled justified. Why? Suspect was coming at me. Suspect could have been reaching for a gun. Suspect was asking to be shot and was a danger to me and others. But the cop in this video is like, no.
No, man. I'm not going to do it.
Shoot me. Shoot me. Shoot me.
Well, once the guy starts coming at him, maybe.
Back up.
And then you hear sirens. Backup is coming.
Get down on the ground.
The suspect turns around and lays down on the ground.
Keep your hands out. Keep your hands out. You want to get shot. You understand that?
Yes, sir.
In the end, nobody shoots anybody.
But they could have. Maybe in other circumstances, they would have. Kelly McCovers tracking that down in New Richmond, Ohio, for the podcast Embedded. She's with us today from Culver City, California. Whoa, that took some restraint. What did you learn when you went to Ohio, Kelly?
Well, there's several questions here, and there's several really interesting things that came out. I mean, talk about, you know, a little video that looks like one thing, and when you start digging, you find out all kinds of other stuff. I mean, there's so many surprises and twists and turns in this story. But one of them is this. Jesse Kidder was a Marine and did...
This is the police officer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did... served in Iraq and says that he was in a, quote, use of force incident in Iraq. He actually got awarded for a combat action ribbon, which means that he took enemy fire and that he, quote, engaged the enemy. That's about all we know from what happened there. But basically what he says is that he knows from experience... He just knew that this guy was not a threat. He saw his hand in his pocket, but he was like, there's not a gun in there. I could just tell. I didn't have to shoot him. And so what's really fascinating about this, right, is that, you know, people think that veterans come back after doing tours in Iraq or Afghanistan and that they're trigger happy, that they're more likely to shoot. But what trainers and police chiefs are seeing actually is that they have more experience in stressful, life-threatening situations than guys who are just getting out of the academy, the police academy, and they actually show more restraint. They know what they're doing, you know. And this brings up this whole point of police training is that, you know, you can go to, you know, civilians watch these videos all the time. They're like, they need more training. They need more training. You can go to a million classes, but nothing can substitute for experience in a life-threatening, stressful situation. We hear trainers say this all the time. Back in the day, you know, guys who would become cops, guys and ladies sometimes, are people who like had worked as bouncers, had gotten in a lot of bar fights, you know, had spent a lot of time on the streets in the neighborhood. And that's not really true anymore. You've got people coming straight out of college or straight out of the academy who just don't have that life experience. And sometimes they are the ones who are more likely, not always, but who are more likely to use force. There's another issue with this case that I feel like I can't not mention. that I have to mention, and that is the fact that Jesse Kidder was white and Michael Wilcox was white.
Yeah.
And a lot of people saw this case and said, well, of course, that's why he didn't shoot him. Look, there's no way, you know, Jesse Kidder says, well, Jesse Kidder's boss at the time says that was not what it was about. And we asked him over and over and over again, and that's the answer that we got. We know confirmation bias exists.
Yeah.
We know even when we say, I'm not a racist, you might still have a confirmation bias that you're not aware of. So, you know, if we could sort of dissect his brain, maybe that was part of it.
Yeah.
But
that's some great tape,
it's a hard thing to quantify. Yeah.
Yep. Let me get one more call here. Charles, Newfield, New Hampshire. Charles, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a truck driver, and I actually got pulled over by a local cop in Omaha, Nebraska. And I didn't realize it at the time, but he basically pulled me over thinking that I owned the truck. And I'm being African-American, you know, in the conversation, he asked me, had I ever been to prison? And he was shocked that I hadn't.
Oh, boy.
And in doing that, he ran my license, and then he did a federal background to concur whether I was telling the truth or not.
Yeah.
And as an African-American, I deal with police. I have to deal with them in a certain way, or I could be killed. And I know that.
Do you think, Charles, do you think that having a video camera running is a protection for you as an African-American or not? Does it give you some?
I do. I really do think it'll protect me because it'll show that I did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it'll deter them from doing something when they don't have to. I mean, I respect the police. I know they have a tough job to do.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I can say things to them in a respectful way that will demand respect as well.
Yeah. Well, let's pray for that. Charles, our time is so short. You waited an hour to speak with us, and I'm glad to have that voice. Charles, thank you very much, and drive safely, and good luck to you always. Kelly, I mean, you can be very sympathetic with the police and what they're up against, but there's an African-American who feels it every moment when he's called, pulled over. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, where might this go?
Fair enough. I mean, you know, and even with a body camera on, as we learned, that's not necessarily going to mean that everybody, you know, acts in their best behavior. And then something might get captured on video that is then later ruled justified. I mean, we're not all the way there yet. One guy told us, like, we've moved the needle a little bit. You know, before we had these videos, the dead man couldn't talk.
Mm.
And now he can. And that's something. It's not everything, but it's getting us somewhere.
Kelly McEvers takes us there with her NPR podcast, Embedded. Kelly, we're really glad you're out there going deep. It's so satisfying to listen to. And we need that kind of engagement with the deep reality behind the news, behind the video. Thanks very much for doing it, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Kelly McEvers, co-host of NPR's All Things Considered and host of the NPR podcast, Embedded, in the midst of its second season right now. You'll hear an episode drop tomorrow and another next week. Check them out. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. And always, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.